The Netflix series Making a Murderer drew international attention to the murder trials of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey.
The disappearance of Teresa Halbach remains a mystery.
Mr. Avery's blood is found inside of Teresa Halbach's vehicle.
Steve, everybody's listening. What do you want to say today?
I'm innocent.
If convicted, Stephen Avery will spend the rest of his life in prison.
We found a key.
That key was scrubbed and his DNA was placed on it.
This is really strange.
What's going on here?
From the trailer there, Making a Murderer highlighted flaws in the prosecution, and the show got people talking about whether or not Avery and Dassey were guilty of the crimes they were convicted of.
Our next guest says there's a bigger story here beyond the details of the case. He says the series highlights serious flaws in Wisconsin's criminal justice system that lead to bias against defendants in criminal trials.
Michael Cecchini joins us now. He's a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha. He blogs at The Legal Watchdog. He's the author of a number of books on the legal system. His latest is Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. He joins us now from our studio in Milwaukee. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You start your book with a reference to a different TV show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and describe Wisconsin from a defendant's perspective as a hellmouth when it comes to criminal justice. A hellmouth. Why is that?
Well, that's, as I put in the introduction, there are so many bizarre things that happen here. Now, I'll admit that practicing in Wisconsin, other criminal defense lawyers and I, we always think we have it far worse than other states. I'll admit a lot of these things do happen in other states, but the fact is I'm here in Wisconsin. I see and live through this stuff all the time, and I give several examples of it, recent Wisconsin case law, recent things that have been in the headlines. So I think we are, especially compared to our neighboring state, Minnesota, we do have a very massive, aggressive criminal justice system. That probably justifies the name Hellmouth.
And you look at that system through the lens of the trials of, multiple trials, actually, of Stephen Avery and the trial of Brendan Dassey. We won't spend too much time on the particulars of those cases, but can you briefly recap what happened in their cases?
Sure. Stephen Avery's first case, about 20 years before his second conviction, he was actually convicted of a rape and assault of Penny Bjornstad, and that was based on erroneous eyewitness identification. And it really was not the accuser's fault. It was due to repeated suggestive identification procedures by the police. Now, in Wisconsin, we've had a number of changes in the law where certain things are highly disfavored and not allowed anymore. So there has been a lot of reform in this area. We don't allow show-up procedures anymore where we bring a suspect or a picture of that suspect singly to a crime victim and say, this is the guy, isn't it? That's a very suggestive way to get an identification, and it's a very unreliable way. That's kind of the highlight of Avery's first trial. Of course, the second trial involved two defendants and two different trials. It was, I should say, a single victim, Teresa Halbach, two defendants, two different trials. And that was for the one that I believe the documentary probably spent 9 of its 10 episodes on the Teresa Halbach case, which resulted in that case, there actually was physical evidence. It did not hinge on an eyewitness identification. And Avery was convicted. And then the thing about Dassey's case, he was convicted without any physical evidence, without an eyewitness identification, almost entirely based on his confession, which, as many of your listeners will probably know, that conviction has now been reversed, and we are awaiting the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision as to whether that reversal of the conviction will be upheld.
And throughout your book, you lay out ways in which the things that we see done on Making a Murderer highlight what you see as deeper problems. And I want to spend a lot of our time looking at some of those specific issues. And here's one. This sounds a little technical, but you say this is a big deal. The way we talk about the burden of proof to our juries and our jury instructions in Wisconsin is different than it works in a lot of states, and it can bias juries against the defendant. Can you explain that?
Sure. The burden of proof in a criminal case, by the way the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the Constitution, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But what is that? It depends on how you define it for the jury. Whenever there's a criminal trial, a jury will get a jury instruction read to them on the burden of proof, and then in most cases, certainly where I practice, they'll get a copy of that instruction. So the burden of proof is only as strong as it's defined. You can label it whatever you want. The problem with Wisconsin's burden of proof on jury instruction is that it discusses reasonable doubt at length, and that in itself, it has several flaws. Other states have rejected much of our language that we use as being unconstitutionally low burden of proof. But Wisconsin's biggest problem is this. The jury's instruction concludes by saying, don't search for doubt, search for the truth. And in my opinion, and I have reasons for holding this opinion, which I'll give in a second, but that lowers the burden of proof to a mere preponderance of the evidence standard. If you think something's probably true, then you are going to convict. Now, compare that to the state of Vermont, their jury instruction. It says that if you find that the defendant is probably guilty, you must find him not guilty if you have a reasonable doubt about the evidence. So they have a much better jury instruction that accurately reflects the burden of proof. Now, that's kind of obvious just from reading the two instructions. It's always been obvious to defense lawyers. We've hated that instruction for a long time. But fans of Making a Murder might remember from episode 3, there was a psychologist, Lawrence White. He and I have done a lot of controlled studies, two controlled studies, and a lot of research on this burden of proof instruction. And in controlled studies, we found that jurors, mock jurors who receive Wisconsin's burden of proof instruction, convict at a much higher rate than jurors who receive a standard burden of proof instruction. In fact, mock jurors who receive Wisconsin's burden of proof instruction convict the same as jurors who receive no reasonable doubt instruction whatsoever. So it's a real problem in the state. Larry White and I, he's a professor at Beloit College in the psychology department. We've published on this extensively. I've asked our jury instruction committee here in the state to change this and just have a simple burden of proof instruction that says you have to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or you know if you can't do that, you have to acquit. So we're trying to make changes on that. I don't know how receptive our jury instruction committee is going to be here in the state, but we've done a lot of research on it. We've published on it. We've done controlled studies, and to me, that's the single biggest problem we're looking at here in the state, is we are convicting defendants all over the state by a mere preponderance of the evidence standard, and it's not constitutionally appropriate.
Talking to Michael Cecchini. He's the author of the new book, Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. I want to move on to another point you tackle in the book, and you mentioned it actually in the case of Brendan Dassey. The way suspects are interrogated, self-incrimination, confessions. A confession seems like it should be rock-solid evidence, but you say the way we handle that in Wisconsin and elsewhere, I think, can subject that to some doubt.
Yeah, the documentary, unfortunately, it couldn't, I mean, it just doesn't have the time to cover all these issues in depth, but they did cover his confession. There were a number of problems with it. It was contradicted by all the physical evidence. The many, if not most, of, and some people would say all of the facts, either were fed to Dassey by the police. And one of the reasons this that it's been reversed, the district court, the federal district court reversed the conviction, because you're looking at not an adult here, but a child who had some learning disabilities, and he was highly suggestible, and he trusted the authority figures. I've read all of the transcripts of his interrogations, and to me, the biggest thing that stands out are the false promises that were repeatedly made to this kid while he was being interrogated. They told him, look, you know, we're cops, yeah, but not right now. We're fathers. We have sons your age, and I'd like to come over there and give you a hug. Now, you can really help yourself by just talking here. And then they proceeded to feed, you know, facts to him and eventually got him to adopt some of those facts. So there were a lot of false promises telling him that what anything he says, you know, the Miranda warning tells us, hey, anything you say can be used against you. No sooner did they give that warning, and sometimes they didn't even give a Miranda warning at all for some interrogations. But and in the interrogations where they did give the Miranda warning, they quickly contradicted that. And instead of after telling him anything you say can be used against you, they hammered away repeatedly that, look, anything you say can help yourself. You're a great guy. This is your chance, you know, to help yourself. So they completely reversed that and overcame Miranda in that way. So Dassey's interrogation, it just has so many problems. I've touched on a few of them. It was just a disaster from start to finish. It was a multi-part interrogation over about a two-day period, often without Miranda, with leading questions, with false promises. And add to that, you're doing this to a 16-year-old child who trusts you. So that's why the confession that it produced was contradicted by all the physical evidence. It's just, I don't think there are many people that really believe that the confession was true.
Talking to Michael Cecchini, he is a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha. His new book is Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you watched the show, did it raise questions for you about how defendants are treated in criminal court and how evidence and eyewitness testimony are handled? If you've been involved in a criminal case as a defendant, a victim, an attorney on either side, do you see problems with the way things work in Wisconsin? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about Wisconsin's criminal justice system. Our guest says the Netflix series Making a Murderer highlights a lot of flaws that stack the deck against defendants. Michael Cecchini stays with us. He's a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha, and his new book is called Convicting Avery, the Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Share your questions, maybe your experiences when it comes to criminal justice in Wisconsin. Do you think the deck is stacked against defendants? What kind of changes would you like to see? Or what do you think is working right? And did Making a Murderer raise questions about how things work when you watched it? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Michael, I want to get into at least one more area. The idea of this being information going out to the public, the trial by media, and potential jury contamination.
Right. That was a big problem. Well, it was a big problem for Avery, I think, or Avery. You'll remember some of your viewers will remember Jerry Buting saying how 129 of the 130 juror questionnaires came back and they indicated something like they believe that Avery was probably guilty or something to that effect. There's actually an ethics rule against that. It doesn't allow a prosecutor to talk about a defendant's alleged confession or about the test results of physical evidence and things like that. And anyone who's seen Making a Murderer knows that that happened. Ken Kratz and the sheriffs and other law enforcement agencies did that. The reason they did that, this was actually an issue that was litigated. It wasn't featured on the documentary, but there's an exception to the ethics rule that they can use that to counter adverse publicity. So they argued that, well, because Stephen Avery said that, well, I've been framed, I'm innocent, that they could get into all those things. Now, the question then becomes, well, what about Brendan Dassey? His trial was certainly impacted as well, and to my knowledge, he did not do radio or television interviews or make any such statements. So I think the documentary did a great job of showing how this pretrial publicity can really poison a jury pool against the defendant. It happened, I think, for both defendants, and it was nicely illustrated in the documentary. And you know, in jury selection, we lawyers, we try and weed out jurors who have formed opinions on that. But unfortunately, the law pretty much allows any juror to sit on the jury. They do not have to give an unequivocal claim that they are not biased. And we certainly don't require that jurors haven't seen or heard anything about a case. So it's a real problem. And it's a difficult problem for defense lawyers to deal with when they're in the middle, when they're in trial and selecting that jury.
Let's go to our callers now. Elizabeth is on the line in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
I work with teenagers, and when I watched that episode on Making a Murderer and they were questioning him, I just had the worst pit in my stomach because I could see that happening to any one of my students and just being brainwashed like that. I thought it was shameful. And I'm kind of wondering, now that the investigators, like, what is it, 10 years down the road, do they recognize that, and can they go back and say, we made a huge mistake? Like, I wonder if they can even sleep at night, because they have to know that what they did was so, so wrong.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. And Michael, I've talked to other people about DNA exonerations in the past where people who did confess in similar situations ended up being exonerated, found innocent, despite a confession because of DNA evidence. So how manipulable are we in these situations?
Yeah, I mean, there's numerous cases that prove that. People do falsely confess to things and they are later exonerated for it with DNA evidence. Now, just think of all the cases where, you know, the vast majority of criminal cases do not involve DNA evidence, so we're never going to be able to completely prove our innocence. So how often is this happening? We know there are a lot of reversals, but we don't know the magnitude of how this is, how often this happens. Now, to Elizabeth's point, she's absolutely right. When you take someone of that developmental level in that age, they view these people as authority figures. And to help Dassey along, they even told him, as I said, look, we're here for you, buddy. You're like, you know, they said, we're not here as police. We're fathers, too. And he would have said anything they told him to say. And you can see this where they repeatedly ask him, come on, something happened to her head, Brendan. What happened to her head? And he keeps guessing and guessing and guessing, and then he doesn't get it right, and then eventually they fill in the blanks for him, and they said she was shot in the head. Who shot her? And then, you know, then of course he agrees with whatever they say. Now, if I can just real quickly answer Elizabeth's other question about, you know, how can they sleep at night? You know, there are, if you read the interrogation transcripts and look at some of the other police reports in this case, some police investigators actually believe that they know the truth. They think that their experience tells them when someone is lying. You know, they were convinced because Dassey reportedly lost weight and because he had been crying a lot. They were convinced, well, this has to be because of the gnawing guilt he's feeling for aiding Stephen Avery. They jumped to that conclusion. They were highly confident and they believed it. They still believe it. If you look at Making a Murderer, and some of those detectives or some of those police officers that were interviewed, sheriff's department employees and deputies, they are not convinced that Avery was innocent of the first crime 20-some years ago. So some people, you know, maybe isn't limited to police officers and detectives. Some people just believe they know things, and you're not always going to change their mind. Some people, no doubt, they will change their mind. Other people won't once they buy into a theory or a theme. There's really no changing it.
Let's take another caller. We've got Dennis on the line in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I have no opinion as far as the Avery or the Dassey case. Just, I have been a jury member in another criminal trial, and the judge told us to not try to find a doubt. And I thought, well, if we don't try to at least explore the edges of doubt, how do we know how far to go with this case? So I questioned various things in my mind, but then when the prosecution and the defense didn't come up with these things I thought of, I thought, well, I can only base my finding on what was presented.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Do you think this is a common experience for a juror, Michael?
I do, and Dennis, thanks for that call. That's one of the things that I'm trying to get changed here is our jury instruction that says don't search for doubt, search for the truth. Dennis brings up a good point. As a criminal defense lawyer, I don't have the time. I might be limited to 20 minutes in closing argument. I might not have the time to bring up all of the problems with the state's case. Now, Dennis is bringing up a scenario where, hey, I thought of real serious problems I have, but yet it wasn't raised by the lawyers, so does that mean I'm searching for doubt? The judge told me not to search for doubt. Our jury instruction, in my opinion, and there's now empirical evidence to support it, is unconstitutional. There are other states that say it is the jury's duty to evaluate the evidence for reasonable doubt. And if there's reasonable doubt, you have to find the defendant not guilty. So I feel for Dennis's position there. He was put in a tough spot thanks to our state's, and presumably he was talking about a Wisconsin jury trial because he virtually quoted our state's jury instruction. Our state has a unconstitutional burden of proof, and I think Dennis just highlighted that.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. We're talking to Michael Cecchini. His new book is Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. Want to get into the idea of eyewitness testimony being a problem. You brought that up in reference to Stephen Avery's first trial. Again, this, I imagine, from a jury perspective, if you've got somebody in a courtroom saying, yes, that's the person, I identify them, I saw them, that's going to be pretty effective. But there's doubt about that.
Yeah, controlled studies show that nothing is, well, few things are more persuasive than a witness taking the witness stand and confidently pointing the finger and saying, hey, that's the guy who, you know, stole my purse or battered me or whatever the crime is. And there's controlled studies, however, that show that eyewitness testimony just isn't reliable. We tend to be overconfident in our memories of things. And on top of that, we saw this illustrated in Making a Murderer. Sometimes things happen after the event that increase our confidence level. For example, the police may show a photograph of one person and say, this is the guy, isn't it? And then the victim says, yeah, I think that is the guy. And they say, good job, you know, good job. And a lot of times there's verbal and nonverbal cues that give feedback to that victim. And then the victim becomes more confident in an eyewitness identification. So eyewitness identification, it's persuasive to a jury, but it's not necessarily reliable in many cases.
Time for one more caller. Daniel is with us in Toma. Daniel, hi.
Hello. Yeah, my modern kind of like, I think our colony is just like, I don't know if it's the same as Taylor or how can you say it is, they neuralize and like
I'm not hearing you very well, Daniel. I've got a bad connection. I'm not making out what you're saying. Sorry about that. Daniel, thanks for trying to call in, though. Michael, what kind of reforms would you like to see? You say some things have changed in Wisconsin, but not all. What do you think would be at the top of your list?
Well, the top of my list is something I've already asked the jury instruction committee to change, and that's our burden of proof. If we could have a burden of proof instruction like Vermont's, which tells the jury, if you have a reasonable doubt, you must find the defendant guilty, even if you think he is probably guilty. That distinguishes between preponderance of the evidence and the high burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I would love to see that change. I've published on that with Larry White. He and I have done controlled studies, and we've shared that with the jury instruction committee, and we're hoping for some legal reform there. Beyond that, it would be tough to say. There are a number of things. I would say the second thing I would choose would be the wrong person defense. The reason I first wrote this book is something Jerry Buting said in the documentary. He said, well, you know, we'd like to tell the jury who we think did this crime, but the judge really tied our hands on that. And what he was talking about is Wisconsin's third-party defense law, also known as the wrong person defense. It's incredibly difficult for a defendant to put on evidence of innocence or evidence that another person committed the crime. The law is very restrictive in that way. It poses very high burdens on the defendant and makes it very difficult to put on that defense. So I would like to see some reform in that area as well. But I think without a doubt our burden of proof jury instruction is the biggest problem.
We'll leave it there for now. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
We've been talking to Michael Cecchini. He's a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha. He's the author of a number of books. His latest, the one we've been talking about, is called Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. You can still keep sharing your thoughts on the issues he raised. And we've got a link, by the way, to a piece he wrote based on some of the work he did for the book. You can find that and share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you've had an experience as a defendant, a victim, a witness, a juror, or on the law side of things, on either side of the court case, we'd love to hear your experiences there. Again, that's all at the Central Time Facebook page.